This is They Create Worlds, episode 207, Sega Saturn, part 2.
If anybody wants to find me, I'll be in the last place you would look. In a place where people used to be, a land that's called reality, you'll find me there.
Welcome to They Create Worlds. I'm Jeffrey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alex.
Hello.
Well, we are now rounding around Saturn, heading back towards Earth. And since this is a long, long flight back, because I'm told that with our conventional thing, just getting to Mars takes months, I can only imagine how long from Saturn this takes. Alex, how about you tell us some more about the Sega Saturn?
Well, indeed, and in fact, I think in order to make this trip from the Saturn back to Earth, we're going to have to make a little stop on Mars, by which, of course, I mean Project Mars, better known as the 32X.
Ah, for the Sega Genesis.
That's right, because you really cannot understand what is happening with the Saturn in this period, particularly in the United States, without also understanding what is happening with the 32X. This is a story that we also touched on a little bit way back in the day in our Dreams of Sega episode. Just as with the Saturn, I don't think we got it quite right back then. Now, we didn't boldly proclaim, or I should say I didn't boldly proclaim, I should not drag Jeffrey, poor Jeffrey, here into my folly. I did not boldly proclaim any takeaways that you should have about the 32X in the last episode that I'm talking about, Dreams of Sega, but there's still a lot of uncertainty around the 32X, far more than there is around the Saturn. A lot of controversy and differing tales of how and why it came into being. Just as with the Saturn, as we talked about last time, we have new Japanese perspectives from Japanese executives on the 32X that allow us to get a little closer. So while what we are going to talk about today could still prove to not be entirely correct, it's not quite as revelatory as some of the Saturn stuff that's come to light. I do think that the way we're going to approach the story today is going to get closer to the truth than sources have in the past and will allow us to demonstrate why the 32X is so important to the Saturn story. Now, this whole episode is not going to be a 32X episode. We're going to then get back to the Saturn's launch and a few of the problems that the Saturn had post-launch, but the 32X is going to be a big part of what we talk about in this episode.
So, like history always changing, the truth is always a moving target.
The truth is out there, Jeffrey. You just have to catch it.
So like the North Star, I can never catch that thing.
Exactly.
But certainly something nice to aim for.
Absolutely. And I think that we'll at least be able to provide a little more nuance on the story today than we were able to in the past, again, because of that all-important Japanese perspective that was somewhat lacking.
So in the last episode, we covered everything dealing with the Saturn. We went way crazy with all the technical stuff. We don't have to talk about that anymore and
yes,
make people's eyes roll over and then start going, oh dear God, I need to start getting out strings and push pins and calculators and figuring out what wire maps work, let alone how a NAND gate works. We just need to continue on and go, hey, there's a Saturn here coming down the pipeline. Hitachi's to blame for having two chips in there. Don't let anyone else say that there was one chip. There's two. There's always been two.
Well, the other way around. Don't let anyone tell you that it started with two. They added the second later. That's the truth we came to.
Okay. We'll come with that truthiness.
That's right. We don't have to get into all of that technical stuff again. But we do kind of need to start the story with the Saturn's completion. We talked about the design. Now we need to talk about the complete product. The product was not complete when the 32X project was started. But by that time, when it truly got started, which was at the very beginning of 1994, the Saturn was kind of finalized. By that time, we knew it was going to be the two SH2 chips plus the SH1 chip. We knew it was going to be the two VDPs. We knew that it was going to be this big, complicated, and expensive piece of hardware. The expensive part of that is the problem. Video game systems, to this point, not adjusted for inflation, obviously, tended not to creep too far above $199, even at launch. The Sega Saturn was looking like it was going to be a $300 to $400 console at launch. This is a bit of sticker shock to a public that is used to a video game system, which, remember, is still regarded largely as a toy at this point, rather than a sophisticated consumer electronic, being much, much cheaper than that.
I remember paying $200 for that Super Nintendo.
Uh-huh, exactly. Genesis, similar. NES, even cheaper. Atari VCS, $200. Now, obviously, $200, or $190, actually, but $190 in 1980 is a lot more money than $180 in 1990. We won't pull out our trusty inflation calculator this time, but obviously, there has been inflation. Things are more expensive in 1990 than they were in 1980, but the public's perception of the expense hasn't moved. The price point has stayed fairly steady. Now we're talking about going up to $400, or technically $399, because of that little psychological trick companies use where when you see a 99, your mind automatically tends to round down instead of rounding up, and so it feels like it's a lot less. Little advertising trick, and why everything you see is something 95, something 99. Etc. Etc.
All for the low, low price of $99.99.
Yes.
Bonus point if you get that reference.
Yes. But anyway, Sega of America was very concerned about this, and they thought that this was going to be an incredible problem. Obviously, this is a system that is going to be more expensive everywhere. It's going to be more expensive in Japan, too. And I'm sure in Japan that they were a little concerned about it. But the concern was even greater for the United States, and this really all comes down to cultural differences. At this time that we're talking about here, late 93, early 94, when Sega of America is coming to grips with the idea that this console is going to be so much more expensive, the bubble economy has already burst in Japan. It's not like Japan is still living the high life that it was living in the 1980s in terms of spending power and all of that kind of stuff. But even though the economy was not doing as well at this time, Japan had a real tradition of doting on children that really sprang from the war, because the war was so horrible and the immediate post-war period was so horrible that when the Japanese economy did finally recover and the economic miracle began and there was a lot of spending power, the generation that grew up in that hardship not only didn't want their kids to experience the same hardship, but took to doting on their kids and giving them the kinds of things that they could not have themselves due to that disaster. So there was kind of a culture of doting on children. And then in addition to that, you have the particular Japanese tradition of otoshidama, which is the gifting of money to children during the New Year's holiday. You know, the Japanese, they kind of celebrate Christmas. Obviously, they're not Christian. They have no real religious tie to the holiday. They have, because of the pervasiveness of Western culture and the American military occupation after the war, et cetera, et cetera. They do have some Christmas traditions, and some families even celebrate and give presents at Christmas. But, of course, they don't have a huge Christmas tradition, especially for Christmas trees and presents under the tree for very obvious reasons.
But they do have a copious amount of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
They do, and now you're going to have to find a video of that to put in the show notes, Jeffrey. You did it to yourself, but
oh,
yes.
Oh, I know exactly which one I'm putting in.
It is very true. It's a tangent that we can't get into here, but check out the show notes if you are ignorant of the KFC Christmas tradition and Colonel Sanders practically being on equal footing with one Mr. Santa Claus, with whom he shares a white beard, in the island nation of Japan. So they have some Christmas traditions, but not a lot of deeply rooted traditions. However, they do still have a holiday tradition at New Year's, and this is at the Western New Year, not the Lunar New Year. That's what I talked about before, the Otoshidama. It probably has its origin, as many of these kind of things do, in ancient Shinto customs involving rice cakes and that kind of thing. It evolved from there at some point into gifting rice cakes to children on New Year's, and then it morphed from there into just gifting cash. We'll try to put something about that in the show notes as well. But the key thing here, and the reason this is important, is that the Otoshidama gift is something that a child tends to receive from all of the adult family members in their lives. Mothers and fathers, parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, presumably even great aunts, great uncles, etc. Like, the whole family chips in. You get a gift of money that's usually in some kind of fancy envelope. The giving of the envelopes very ceremonially is part of this whole thing. The amount of money that you give is generally pretty prescribed based on your relationship. It can be as little as 1,000 yen to as much as 5,000 or more yen. Remember that that is nowhere near equivalent to dollars, but that's still a very good chunk of change for a child. While parents, if their child gets a lot of money, may force them to set aside some of it for savings, on the whole, that money that you get as the child is yours to spend on whatever you want. So this is the time, obviously, that children tend to make the big expensive purchases, like, say, video games, because they have this influx of money. So in Japan, a lot of the spending, not all of it, obviously, but a lot of the spending on these high-ticket items like video games is driven by the children, and it's fine because that money is the child's money. They got the money, go spend it on whatever they want. In the United States, of course, and in Europe, the emphasis is more on getting gifts at Christmas. Yes, you sometimes give kids money too, but a lot of the emphasis is on giving gifts. So those high-ticket items are not being bought so much directly by the child as they are by the parent. So because the parent is the one actively taking part in this purchasing, they are far more sensitive to and far more cognizant of the cost going into this. So as you can imagine, this means that a high-priced item like that, not that Japanese parents are necessarily going to be happy about expensive items, not that some of that same stuff doesn't go on in Japan, but I'm sure you can see from that that in the West, a big high-ticket, high-priced toy item like that is going to receive far more scrutiny and far more pushback than it would in Japan.
Yeah, I can see that. If you have a culture that's around, hey, I just want to spoil a kid, do something really nice for them, and then they got money that's going to come down the line. So I can certainly see where they go, oh yeah, I'll buy them this console and a game for Christmas. And then for New Year's, they'll get an envelope with enough yen that they can buy a couple games for it.
They're not even necessarily getting the console for Christmas. I mean, they might get enough money for the system at New Year's through the Otoshidama. You know, that's kind of the key there.
Gotcha. But then, yeah, in the United States, especially back in the 80s and 90s, they're going like, all right, your big ticket items on Christmas, maybe we'll buy you something here. That's $200,
$300. $300, yeah, which is a lot of money at that time.
I mean, heck, it's still a lot of money now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Usually, especially if you have like more than one kid, you're trying to budget for Christmas for not just the kid, but also other relatives, maybe even your spouse or whatever.
It's like exactly.
Myself, I budget like, hey, this is how much I have to give to my nephews. Here's how much I plan for my local relatives. Here's the amount I'm setting aside to buy my wife's stuff. Here's the money I set aside to take my friends out to go eat dinner sometime during the Christmas holiday. It's all good.
Exactly. Obviously, today, consoles are routinely $400, $500, $600. But two things there, of course. First, inflation. It's 30 years later, and inflation is a thing. But also, second of all, as we've said, you know, video games have permeated the culture more thoroughly. It is not just a toy. It is far more sophisticated. It is a consumer electronic product that is considered in the same category as a laptop computer or a television or a, not that people have stereo systems anymore, but whatever it is you're playing your music on these days, it's more in that category. And those kind of prices feel different when it's an adult item that perhaps the entire family is using, as opposed to back then when video games were still primarily a children's item and a toy. That's a lot to pay for a toy. back then, you know, a big toy, like a playset or something, you know, that wasn't electronic, the biggest ones probably topped out somewhere in the $100 or $150 range. And even that was rare. Most were far cheaper. So then to go above that for a toy that not only costs $300, $400, $400 in this case, but also you have to buy games to go along with it. It's like, come on now.
Also, you got to kind of think of that there. You keep saying, bringing up the whole toy thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
From an adult perspective, especially back then, a toy is something that the child is going to play with. Then it's either going to be destroyed, lost, forgotten, thrown in the trash within, let's say, roughly a year.
Right.
Typically.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I've seen that with a lot of my own toys. I've seen that with a lot of other people's toys. From a parent's perspective, okay, the kid's playing with this thing and he's just going to destroy or trash it within a year and I'm spending $200 on this? That's ridiculous.
And let's remember, too, that it was probably only a year or two ago that these same parents spent $150 or $200 buying a Genesis or a Super NES for their child. At its height, the SNES was $249 when it first launched, but it very quickly came down to $200 to compete with the Genesis that cut its price to $150. That's kind of what we're looking at. So it was just a couple of years ago that they did that. And now you're saying that I have to buy you this $400 thing. And, you know, what am I doing a year or two from now? Buying you an $1,000 thing? Where does it stop?
Mm-hmm.
These are very real concerns. And so Sega of America was deathly afraid that the Saturn was going to be a disaster because of the cost. Knowing this, and this is something that's come out of a little bit from both American and Japanese executives, knowing this is what makes the whole next sequence of events make sense. Because it became Sega of America's mission at this point to find a cheaper alternative to the Saturn for the U.S. market.
Specifically for the U.S. market, so they initially didn't intend to put this out in Japan.
It was not being driven by a need for Japan. Now, whatever they came up with, there was a good chance it was also going to arrive in Japan as well. But that was not the impetus. Like, the Japanese did not feel that they needed a product somewhere between a Genesis and a Saturn. Would they have built some in Japan, as of course they did? Yeah, of course. But without America specifically, I'm sure this was also a big problem in Europe, but it was the Americans driving this. It was Tom Kalinske and his team driving this, not Nick Alexander and his people in Europe. Without the U.S. driving it, I don't think they would have made any kind of system occupying this strange in-between space between a Genesis and a Saturn. So there were a few ideas on how to do this. One of those is that the Americans were very interested in finding some kind of hardware alternative to the Saturn that was still the next generation advanced 32-bit system, but was maybe not so complicated, maybe not with so many parts in it, so many chips, and could maybe be released for a slightly lower price. So that's where we get this very brief dalliance that we've talked about in other episodes with Silicon Graphics. We, of course, talked about Silicon Graphics in the last episode about how they were one of the companies that was pushing forward this incredible new idea of the graphics workstation with their computers being used on such movies as The Abyss, Terminator 2, and Jurassic Park. They were also looking for other avenues to use this technology and to get into the consumer space. So they had the beginnings of a video game chipset. They owned a chip company, MIPS, which also provided the chips for their silicon workstations, silicon graphics workstations. They had the beginnings of a system that they were prototyping that would basically be a video game system harnessing the power of a silicon graphics workstation, but in a cheaper, smaller video game form factor. So they went to Sega, a logical place to go. Kalinske met with them and was very impressed with Jim Clark and his stuff. But as we talked about in other episodes, they went to Japan and Japan was like, no, not interested. The chip's too big, by which we mean it would be too expensive to manufacture because the bigger the chip, the fewer chips on the wafer. And when you have a new chip, you always have a higher failure rate. So the fewer chips on the wafer, the far lower the yield rate and costs go up, yada, yada. We talked about that in other episodes. That all still holds true. So because Sato felt that the chip was too big and would have too low a yield rate and drive up costs too much, they turned that down. But I do believe, even though Kalinske doesn't say this outright, I mean, this is at the time the Saturn was already being developed and Kalinske knew the Saturn was being developed. And Kalinske in interviews has said that it was about, you know, finding an alternative to the Saturn. But I don't know that he necessarily put it in as stark a terms as we are here, which is that I do believe the primary driver of that. Don't have direct quotes, but it only makes sense, is that they were terrified over the price. And obviously, when the N64 comes out a couple years later, and it is a couple of years later, which means, of course, technology has come down in price a little bit, which is, you know, no doubt part of it. That N64 is, while still expensive, while still pricier, the last generation of consoles was significantly cheaper than an at-launch $399 Sega Saturn. I have to imagine that part of the allure of that hardware to Kalinske was that he felt that it would be cheaper. But Sato, because of the chip size and the chip newness and everything, disagreed, and that went nowhere. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is that they wanted to look at something that would feel next generation, that would be some kind of leap forward over a Genesis, but would not be the expensive behemoth that the Saturn was. Because remember, I think everyone at this point is still, even after the PlayStation reveal, is still operating to a degree on the idea that the next generation is not going to be a fully 3D polygonal generation, or quadrilateral generation, as the Sega Saturn would make it out to be. I think the thought still was at this point that it's going to be a generation driven by really great 2D sprite-based games with a little bit of 3D experimentation. Obviously, even the last generation, it had a little bit of 3D experimentation, see Star Fox, but, you know, something a little bit beyond that, but still not going full 3D. So I think the Sega of America staff, and this is a little bit of speculation, but it lines up very well with the facts. I think that the Sega of America staff were feeling that they didn't necessarily need that full-blown leap into what the Saturn was going to be providing on the 3D end to make a go of it. So they started making big, big requests to Japan to come up with something that would bridge the gap for them. So the Japanese engineers started working on this, and what they came up with initially was basically what I just said. Let's take something very much like the Genesis. Let's boost the sprite capabilities by a fair amount, increase the number of colors and increase the number of sprites, presumably increase how much you can do with various effects like transparencies and fog and rotation and scaling and all of that stuff. Then let's take our SVP chip, which was essentially the Sega version of the FX chip. Now, it was not as effective as the FX chip, but they did create a chip that they put in some games, just like Nintendo did with Star Fox, that was a 3D chip, the SVP. Let's extend that a little bit and integrate it into this system. And so what you come up with, and this was not the official name of it, I don't want to give that idea, but what you have essentially come up with is something sort of like a Genesis 2. It's Genesis, but it's Genesis with better sprite-based graphics and the ability to do some 3D on the margins. That seemed like a reasonable compromise point between these two extremes of the Genesis and the Saturn.
Are you sure they didn't just like take the Super Nintendo and take Star Fox and then sort of meshed it together in a blender and then poured that into the Genesis to sort of make it look all pretty and extra nice?
Well, probably throw Donkey Kong Country in there too, right?
Right.
You know, take the Super Nintendo, the Donkey Kong Country, and the Star Fox, and put them all in a blender and come up with something that does all of that natively. And I don't know what the exact specs would have looked like.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to say that that's exactly what it would be, but I mean, that's in a way kind of the logic we're talking about here.
What I remember is the Genesis and the Super Nintendo were sort of the rival thing going back and forth, but it always seemed, at least to me, that whenever I was playing a Genesis game, is that at least from a graphical standpoint, it was always less capable than the Super Nintendo was.
It was, yes.
The Super Nintendo had more layers, more transparency.
Way more colors.
Way more colors.
Way more colors.
Especially with the colors. And then you start playing some of the later games like Donkey Kong Country, Star Fox, Secret of Evermore comes to mind,
mm-hmm.
where you just have this beautiful setup of how things look that looks so different from how when the thing launched. I never really got that sort of sense of progression with the Genesis.
Right.
I played plenty of fun games for the Genesis, but I'd never seen that same level of progression where they just really took something and pushed it to its utter limit in such a beautiful way.
Yes, I agree. Probably in part because they got hung up on peripherals like the Sega CD. I absolutely agree with you on that observation. This seemed perhaps like a reasonable compromise, but it didn't feel far enough to Kalinske and, well, most importantly, the head of R&D at Sega of America, Joe Miller. They felt that, okay, yes, we kind of asked for something like this. That's fair. However, it feels like if we're going to be releasing a whole new system, that this is actually a little bit too weak to be a whole new system, because it does in some ways feel like you're just taking a Genesis and doubling the colors. Now, I'm not saying that's exactly what it was doing, because again, we don't have the specs. And we do know from Joe Miller interviews that there was some 3D capability in this initial concept as well, based on the SVP. So I'm not saying that all they were doing, because Kent's book, which was kind of our first source on all of this, kind of gives the impression that all that was being proposed by Japan was a system that doubled the colors. And that's not true. But at the same time, even though that's not true, it would be very easy to fall into the trap of looking at something like this and saying, that's all it's doing. And they're making me, you know, buy this thing. What the heck? The other issue is that there was a complete gap between Sega in Japan and Sega of America in the way that they viewed the Sega Genesis at this point. The Sega Genesis was not a flop in Japan. It didn't lose Sega a ton of money or anything in Japan, but it was the third place system. Of course, it was called the Mega Drive over there, as it was in the entire world outside of the United States. The Mega Drive was the third place system, not only being bested by Nintendo, but also being bested by NEC with their PC Engine, known in the West as the TurboGrafx-16, or known in America, I should say, as the TurboGrafx-16. Sega was ready to completely move on from that generation of console. The Saturn was going to be a bold new era. As we know, especially from more recent console generations, when you have a transition, there's generally a period where there's an overlap and you're still actually selling a lot of your older system, especially older games for your older system, even as the newer system comes in, because it's mature technology, it's cheaper, it has a larger game library. So there's always kind of this overlap period of a couple of years where your Xbox 360 is selling as well or better as your Xbox One, or your PS4 is selling as well or better as your PS5, or, you know, everybody still sort of wants a Wii and nobody wants a Wii U. Not that anyone wanted a Wii by that point either, but you get the point. There's always that transition period. In this case, Sega in Japan was not particularly interested in having a transition period because there was nothing to transition from in Japan. The Mega Drive was fine, but its time was over. This was not in any way the case in America and in Europe. We're mostly focusing on America here only because it was Sega of America that was really driving this process that creates the 32X. Most of what I'm saying about the US also does apply to the UK and many European countries. It's just they're not relevant to the specific conversation that we're having here. It was a very different matter in the United States, where the Genesis was very popular. The Genesis was still selling. Genesis games were still selling. And they didn't just want to abandon that audience. Whereas if they followed Japan's lead, they would be switching basically all of their development over to the next generation and ignoring the Mega Drive / Genesis. Kind of as a counterpoint to this proposal by Japan, Joe Miller and his team, and this was done during the January CES in 1994, when everyone, you know, was kind of gathered together from Japan and the U.S. all in one place. Sato's there as well, head of R&D in Japan. But Miller and his team kind of start brainstorming with the Japanese engineers and come up in its place with, why don't we create an add-on for the Genesis? Because that's going to extend the life of the Genesis, which we very much want to do because it's still popular here. But why don't we increase its capabilities just a little bit more and use those same SH2 processors, the dual processors, that are in the Saturn, in this add-on? It's not going to be a Saturn. It's not going to be as powerful as a Saturn. It doesn't have the VDPs. It's going to still be driving a lot of the video processing back through to the Genesis from the 32X, since it's a peripheral. Why don't we use those SH2s? Let's put a slightly greater emphasis on doing 3D on this. And this will also serve as a bridge for developers, because even though developing on a 32X and developing on a Saturn are completely different just because they have the same processor, it's meaningless, it will still get them used to doing polygonal games, 3D graphics, all of this stuff, which, as we talked about in last episode, is a skill set that basically no console developers had, and is a very different skill set from doing 2D games. You cannot just translate 2D game design and art skills into 3D without a significant amount of retraining of yourself, unless you're one of the very rare polymaths out there that can do it all. And of course, that does not describe most people, and so it also doesn't describe most game designers. So this is how what came to be called Project Mars — they didn't name it that at the time, but it did eventually come to be called Project Mars, keeping with the planet theme — this is how Project Mars came about. This is how the 32X came about. It came about entirely because America, A, didn't want to abandon the large Genesis install base that they already had, and B, because they were deathly afraid that the Saturn was not going to go over well with the public due to the price. Everyone aligned on this. I mean, Japan agreed to it as well, that they would do this kind of stopgap thing. And so the Saturn would come out in Japan at the end of 1994. Remember, this is January 1994 when we're having these conversations. And the Saturn would not come out in the U.S. till at least another year after that. In the meantime, Sega of America would ease its consumer base into this new world order through this peripheral for the Genesis. As we know, this was a bad idea. And we don't need to talk about the failure of the 32X again in this episode. And believe me, it was a failure. But you can kind of see why they wanted to do it, because at the time — and this is, again, according to Joe Miller's interview with our good friend Ken Horowitz from Sega 16, at that time, the full extent of the disaster of the Sega CD wasn't well known yet either. You know, we talked in some of our more recent Sega episodes about, in our Sega and CSK episodes, how it turned out that Sega of America wasn't as successful as everyone at the company thought it was, because they had sold a lot of inventory into retail. Then a lot of that didn't get bought, so retail sent it right back. Sega was caught in a position where there was a lot of sell-in sometimes, which is the stock that you give to retailers, but not always a lot of sell-through, which is the stock that the retailers actually sell to consumers. With their big partners like Toys R Us and Walmart, as we've talked about before, those retailers are never going to be on the hook for this stuff. These retailers make you buy back the inventory that they don't sell. And obviously there's some negotiation and give and take, and they'll say you have to take it all back for full price. And then, you know, maybe the manufacturer says, okay, we'll do that, but if we do, you're not going to get our next great thing that's coming out. So do you really want to do that? And, you know, then it's back and forth. But generally speaking, that's how it works. The retailer is not going to be on the hook for that inventory. The manufacturer is. Joe Miller indicates that part of the reason why this peripheral idea was a good idea for them at the time was the success of the Sega CD. I don't really consider the Sega CD necessarily all that successful, though it did move like a couple of million units or something. But I think probably a lot of that inventory hadn't backed up on Sega yet, which is why he was thinking it was more successful. They were like, okay, the Sega CD worked out well. This will work out well, too. And, you know, in fairness, they were able to convince retailers this was a great idea. Retailers bought like a million of them, then failed to sell like 80% of them to the public, which, of course, then became part of that inventory glut that Sega had to buy back that we talked about in our Sega CSK episodes. It's all connected. Who knew? So this is why they kind of thought this was a good idea. They were wrong about the public's appetite for it. They were wrong about the public's perception of this kind of stopgap measure versus just going out and buying an expensive new video game system. In part because, of course, at this point, they had no idea that in June of 1995, Steve Race of Sony Computer Entertainment America was going to utter his famous $299. So they didn't know that there was going to be a competitor on the market offering a full 3D experience for $100 less than they were. That's not something that was in their crystal ball. So for a whole lot of reasons, this Sega 32X thing is never going to take off. But it is so important for understanding the uncertain environment that Sega was in and how Sega was making poor choices, mostly because they were in such a confusing transitional time, which we talked about in the previous episode. They didn't know what the market was going to look like, and so they hedged their bets and didn't go all in on the new, on the brand new, and decided to do a halfway thing as well that, of course, then didn't work out. Why didn't this halfway thing work out? Well, we already talked about some of the reasons just now, obviously, but the big thing that we have to talk about now, the elephant in the room that we've alluded to a few times, is, of course, Sony and the PlayStation. Obviously, in the previous episode, we already talked about how the PlayStation being revealed and the final specs being revealed and the number of polygons it could theoretically push being revealed is what drove this rather disastrous adoption of a dual processor architecture. So that was already something that Sony caused, but the Sony problem goes beyond that, and this is not an episode on the creation of the PlayStation or the marketing of the PlayStation, so don't want to go too far down that road. But we do have to talk about a few things to further understand why Sega was caught so off guard by this generational transition, so off guard that they thought things like, oh, we can just make a kick-ass 2D system that does just a little 3D, or, oh, we can just extend the Genesis a little bit with this halfway solution. All of that came down to the fact that they underestimated, quite frankly, how Sony was going to approach game development. We may recall from the previous episode that the primary reason that the Saturn was initially designed to be a very powerful 2D system with only limited 3D capabilities is not because Hideki Sato and Sega's R&D team couldn't see that 3D polygonal future. They saw it. It was happening right down the hall, metaphorically speaking, not literally, in the coin-op division where games like Virtua Racer and Virtua Fighter and Daytona USA were under development. What they really feared is that developers would not be ready to harness 3D for all the reasons that we've talked about before, about how that's a very different process, creating a game using polygons as opposed to creating a game using sprites. You know what? The rest of the development community agreed with them, both inside and outside Sega. For example, when Yuji Naka and his folks came back to Japan, leaving the Sega Technical Institute, retaking up residence in Japan as Sonic Team, the game that they started creating at that time, which became Nights into Dreams, started out as a 2D side-scroller. Because that's what it looked like the hardware was going to be capable of, and that's what it looked like the direction of the industry was going to be. Externally, at third parties, when Sony was shopping around their PlayStation hardware in the very early days, they were basically scoffed at by all of the third parties, not just because of Sony's inexperience in video games, but also because they said there's no way that we're all going to be ready and that this kind of 3D technology is going to be ready. At this time, the next generation is still going to be primarily driven by sprites. Then Virtua Fighter was released, and we talked about this irony in one of our episodes way back when. Might have been Dreams of Sega, might have been another, I don't recall. But then Virtua Fighter was released And that's what showed the industry this could happen. If they can do that in the arcade, even though obviously a coin-op hardware is going to be more sophisticated than a home hardware, then, okay, next generation in the home, we are going to be able to do some 3D polygonal stuff. So in a way, Sega accidentally shot itself in the foot because it was their own coin-op game that convinced the Japanese development community that Sony could deliver a fully 3D home system. Once the development community bought into the PlayStation as something that was viable, according to Sato and others at Sega, interest in doing 2D games in the next generation completely evaporated. Nobody wanted to anymore. I'm not just talking like inside of Sega. I'm talking about outside of Sega. I'm talking about third-party developers and publishers. All interest in going sprite for the next generation vanished. This is a serious problem because the Saturn does the 2D stuff really well and is presumably, I don't know this for a fact, but is also presumably easier to do on a Saturn because since that second processor was specifically added to offload some of the 3D graphics processing, presumably to create a really good 2D game, you don't have to program both of those processors and spend a lot of time balancing the load on those two processors to make a good game. Now, there's no way that the Saturn is going to be able to compete with the PlayStation on the grounds of, okay, maybe their 3D is kind of cool, but look at this really pretty sprite-based game I made. Because nobody's going to make those. So this system is now going to live or die on the willingness of third parties to create 3D quadrilateral, not polygonal, but quadrilateral games on the Saturn. That means balancing the load between two processors in a time when nothing, virtually nothing, was using multiple processors.
Not only do you have to understand how to do all this newfangled 3D stuff, you have to figure out how to do scheduling and threading in order to share the workload between multiple processors.
Exactly. I mean, you know, my latest computer I bought has, I forget even, it has like 30-something cores or something. I don't know. It's ridiculous. But back then, the idea of multi-core, and of course, the Saturn's not multi-core because it's two processors, not multiple processors sharing a socket. The concept of multi-core, which is so common today, was in its infancy and was not in consumer products. You basically just had one processor in something. You may have a daughter processor doing some special stuff like controlling sound, but you didn't really have GPUs. That wasn't a thing yet. The idea of having more than one CPU wasn't really a thing yet. You would have one processor, and then you'd maybe have some customs graphics hardware like the VDPs or like the chips in the Amiga, but they're not full-fledged processors. And then maybe you have a secondary processor that you're using as a controller for something very specific, like sound. But you're not balancing and multi-threading and scheduling, as you said. So this is an entirely new concept in consumer electronics, and even though it would later be commonplace, that was a problem. Obviously, the PlayStation also has a more complex architecture than past consoles. We're not going to get all into its hardware. I mean, it doesn't have a dual processor setup, but it does have a GPU. And you do have to do complicated things like passing your data through the video RAM to the GPU, which is very narrow, it was 2 megabytes. So there were a lot of challenges involved with programming a PlayStation as well. However, this is where the other critical error comes in, and it's an error that came in really just because Sega was a company that was set in its ways. One of Sony's advantages is they had never really been in the industry before, just a very small amount of third-party game development and publishing. Since they had never been in the industry anymore, they weren't bound by any conventional thinking. From the dawn of time in home video games, no longer necessarily always true in coin-op, but in home video games, home video game consoles, games were always done in assembly.
Assembly, kids, is very hard to program.
Yes, high-level languages were not used. The reason for that is, quite frankly, that they were too resource-intensive. On those more primitive systems, even on 16-bit systems, like the Genesis, they used a 68000. you could not afford the slowdown and the increase in memory usage that would be required to use a high-level language, which then has to be translated into something that is understandable by the processor. So everything was done in assembly. Yes, as you said, assembly is hard. Assembly is even harder when you have two processors and two video display chips.
Yeah, that just makes it harder. And I guess you're going to get to this at some point, but the PlayStation provided APIs that make it so that you can access all of this stuff and obfuscate away from having to talk to the hardware directly.
Exactly.
Which is why it made it easier and why things like people who said, screw that, I'm going to do assembly and be crazy anyway, is how you get Crash Bandicoot to go, we are awesome and cool and can do crazy things no one else can do because we're ignoring those APIs.
Exactly.
That's a perfect example of where assembly gives you a lot of power and capability to take full advantage of the system. It is insanely hard to program for, but the APIs that a lot of the modern systems provide, that just makes it so much more accessible to everyone to just not have to have such a deep knowledge. They can just have a basic understanding of how to program and focus on their game and proceed from there. Sort of like engines that we've talked about a lot in the last bunch of episodes. All the different coding engines that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
They remove that nitty-gritty detailed stuff that's already more or less solved.
Exactly. Sega's internal staff had been doing things in assembly language for years. They were very much experts at assembly language. And believe me, it was difficult for their internal teams to translate their skills over to the Saturn as well. But even despite that, they came at this from the idea of, well, yeah, assembly's tough, but we've all been doing it for video games for a long time, so there's no need to change now. Whereas Sony had to attract developers to their system because Sony's the outsider. Sony has to convince publishers it is worth their while to release their games on their system. They have to convince them that this system is actually going to sell to the people in sufficient quantities that it is worth developing on it. And many of the original developers that they went to basically all said, come back to me when you've sold a million. Because that was considered to be the install base that you needed to turn a decent enough profit on the third-party software. Nintendo and Sega is a foregone conclusion, as far as publishers at the time were concerned, that as long as they didn't just completely screw up the tech, they were going to reach a million units because they have a track record going back several generations. Sony has no such track record. There's no proof that they can get distribution. There's no proof that they can manufacture it and deliver it. There's no proof that all of this crazy proprietary hardware they're using, because they did not use off-the-shelf stuff, they used all custom Sony stuff, was going to work the way Sony said it was. There's no track record. So most publishers came back and said, come back to me when you've sold a million and we'll talk. But to get those few publishers that did get on board at the very beginning, like Namco, who coincidentally was Sega's biggest rival in coin-op and did not like Sega one bit and was also mad at Nintendo for their practices. To get those companies like Namco that came on early, they made it as easy as possible to work with the system. And part of that was, of course, developing those APIs that you discussed, allowing developers to program in high-level languages like C, or to use these APIs to facilitate interaction with the system to just make it that much easier. Sega already lost any desire by anybody to do 2D games on the Saturn. Then, when faced with the horrific development environment on the Saturn compared to the smooth development process on the PlayStation, the choice was once again obvious. And this was not just a Sega mistake, because we're talking about Sega because this is the Saturn episode, but when the N64 comes out just a couple years later, it is also notoriously hard to program for. And of course, Sony promptly forgot all of these lessons, because once they creamed everybody in the market with the PlayStation, they decided they didn't need to, hold anyone's hands anymore, and they created the PlayStation 2, and especially the PlayStation 3, both of which were difficult to get the most out of, especially the PlayStation 3, which people remember more since it was such a failure. But even the PS2, successful as it was very hard to work with as well. But for this generation, Sony went with ease of use over other considerations and won over the third-party developer and publishing community. So at this point, basically nobody was that interested in doing much development on Saturn. And those few companies that did stick with it on the Saturn, most of them ultimately decided after their firsthand experience on both systems that the PlayStation was the way to go. Now, Sony, being a rich company, also did throw around a lot of money to get exclusives. That was more insurance than anything else. Even without that, I think it's pretty clear that developers and publishers were going to primarily focus on the PlayStation and not give too much thought to the Sega Saturn. That, at this point, really brings us up to the launch of the system in Japan at the end of 1994. The thing that we have to remember, and the thing that really throws into stark relief how bad these screw-ups were long-term, is that the Sega Saturn, upon launch in Japan, was a success. And it was more successful in the beginning than the PlayStation. In that first December 1994, when both systems were available, Saturn, 500,000 units sold. PlayStation, 300,000 units sold. And it wasn't a sellout. It wasn't that Sony was only able to get 300,000 systems into stores. The Saturn was a sellout, and there were still PlayStations on store shelves. Now, they weren't piling up on store shelves. It was still doing very well. But the point is, it's the Saturn that sold out, not the PlayStation. And there are two words for why this is the case. Virtua Fighter. Because at this time, those Sega coin-op games, 3D coin-op games, were all the rage. And in Japan, nothing was more all the rage than Virtua Fighter. So to be able to bring that game home, as Suichiro Yamajiri said in one of the interviews that was translated by John Harrison, when they decided to enhance the Saturn, which ultimately ended up with them putting in the second SH2 processor, the goal was to make sure the system could run Virtua Fighter. That was the benchmark in terms of 3D capability. Will it run Virtua Fighter? Because even at that time, Virtua Fighter was a huge hit in the arcade, and they knew that being able to bring a faithful version of that into Japanese homes was going to propel them to success. And it did at first. Of course, there were no games bundled with it. Even in the US in this generation, bundling was starting to go by the wayside, but bundling was never a thing in Japan. But Virtua Fighter, which was unbundled, sold at a virtually one-to-one ratio with the Sega Saturn upon launch in Japan. This was a humongous event. And then into the next year, another very popular game that Sega had in the arcade was the racing game Sega Rally, and they released a version of Sega Rally on the Saturn. That also helped to drive sales of the Saturn. They had these big 3D hits in the arcade that the Saturn was able to bring home good enough, well enough, to entice the video game paying public. But nobody else was really making games for the system, and here is where the problem comes in. This is very similar to the problem that the N64 would have when it launched later. It's so interesting how many of the same mistakes that Sega and Nintendo made. Those initial releases drove system sales, but then there were no exciting releases for a long time after that. Meanwhile, on the PlayStation, game after game after game after game is coming out. Some of them are good, some of them are crap, but the point is they're there. And they're cheaper because Sega, again, was still kind of trapped in its old ways, and they didn't adjust cost structures and royalty structures and licensing structures for the new reality of CD. They were still charging the same licensing fees, the same manufacturing costs, all of this stuff that they had been doing in their earlier generations, despite the fact that they were using a cheaper medium. Whereas Sony was like, which remember was the co-inventor of the CD, is like, this CD is new and cheaper and great, and we're going to take advantage of that. So they charged lower licensing fees and all of this kind of stuff. After that initial splurge, sales really start to trail off. And in Japan, it sells about 6 million units over its lifetime, which is not bad, but, you know, Sony was selling way more than that. within a year, Sony was taking a 2-to-1 lead over the Saturn in total sales and never looking back. Now, of course, in America, things were even more complicated. We've talked about a lot of that already in, like, our Dreams of Sega episode and whatnot, and all of that still remains fairly true today, so we don't have to rehash all of that again. But basically, Sega was scared to death of Sony. Sega management in Japan believed very strongly that the Saturn had to get out before the PlayStation in the United States to start building loyalty and market share. So they famously moved up the release date. It was supposed to come out on Sega Saturn Day in September. And then they made their surprise announcement at E3, which, of course, we will put in the show notes. Any longtime listener to the podcast knows that this epic E3 keynote stuff has been preserved for posterity on the YouTube. Made the surprise announcement that the system was already available. As of that day, 30,000 systems had been shipped to 4 retailers. Then, of course, Steve Race from Sony Computer Entertainment America comes up, says $299, and the battle is over before it even began. In fact, for all of that, with the early release and everything, Sega is only able to sell 80,000 units by the end of the year, whereas Sony sells 100,000, and that is a sellout. Sony sells out their stock, but they only have 100,000 at first. All of that head start did was piss off a bunch of retailers, cause a lot of games not to be ready for launch, particularly from third parties, all to be outsold by 20,000 units anyway. Good job, team. Of course, it only got worse from there because they didn't have that killer app at the start. Virtua Fighter was not a big success in the United States. The United States was still very much Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat country, and even though Virtua Fighter was a very well put together game, it was a slower paced game than those flashy 2D fighters, and of course, the graphics in many ways were not as impressive. Now, I mean, they're incredibly impressive polygonal graphics for the time, but if you're talking about flashy art style, no, they don't compare to the colorful fighters of Street Fighter II. So the United States never embraced Virtua Fighter in the same way that Japan did. So that was not a killer app for the United States. They didn't really have a killer app for the United States. And then even when they did get killer apps in the West, they ended up shooting themselves in the foot or getting shot accidentally, one could say. Because one thing that people may not remember is that Tomb Raider was actually released on the Saturn first, before it was released on the PlayStation. A series that is so indelibly linked to the PlayStation, but the first one came out on the Saturn first. It was only by a couple of months. It's not like it was exclusive for 2 years or something, but it came out first. The reason for that is Core Design. It had a long working relationship with Sega. So out of loyalty and out of familiarity, they made the Saturn the lead console for Tomb Raider. However, during that couple-of-month gap between the releases, they had a chance to further polish the game. So the PlayStation version actually fixes some bugs and is a better version than the Saturn version. So even when they got a very brief exclusive of what could have been a killer app in the form of Tomb Raider, it immediately worked against them because, of course, the PlayStation already had the larger install base than the Saturn. And then you have this hot new game, Tomb Raider, and when you compare the two versions side by side, the PlayStation version is better than the Saturn version, so which one are you going to buy? Obviously. Then, of course, Nintendo releases the N64, and that is really the end. Because at this point, the video game market is quite simply not yet big enough or robust enough to support 3 consoles. There was always going to be a loser. By this time, you had Sony with the cheaper system with way more games than anyone else, and you had Nintendo with this incredible Mario 64 game doing 3D like no one had ever seen before. Even though Nintendo is going to end up faltering for the same reason Sega did, not enough games to follow up the launch, for the first half a year that the N64 was on the market in the US, even close to a year, I think, rather than half a year, that thing was selling like bonkers. It was outselling the PlayStation. It was on track to catch the PlayStation. And then, of course, in the middle of 1997, it fell off because game releases fell off. So with Sony leading the roost and Nintendo charging hard to catch up, there was no place left at all for the Saturn in the United States, let alone Europe, where Sony did an incredible job of marketing the PlayStation and leaving no oxygen left for anybody to pick up any pieces. So at the point the N64 came out, any chance at that point for a turnaround was gone. So there you have it. I mean, that's the Saturn. I hope that in these two episodes, and I know these two episodes are slightly shorter than some of our recent fare, which probably comes as a relief to some of you, I realize. I know it comes as a relief to Editor Jeffrey when he sits down at his computer.
Editor Jeffrey here, yes.
It was one of those strange situations where if we had done it as one episode, it would be too long. But there wasn't a good place to do two episodes where they'd be equal. So this episode is a little short, but I mean, it's not short, but it's a little short compared to what we normally do. I hope that by splitting this into two parts and going really in depth on the decision making behind all of the choices that Sega made on both the Saturn and the 32X, which are very much interrelated, that you can start to see why Sega screwed up so badly, but not just why they screwed up so badly. Because to put a more positive spin on it, see why it was just very hard in this period to figure out what to do. You know, Trip Hawkins famously, you know, was marketing the 3DO at the time, famously said about Sony somewhere in the middle of this that, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, in regards to Sony, for a new company, I sure would have hoped that they would have made more mistakes by now than they did. Which is to say that Sony's development and launch of the PlayStation was so flawlessly executed in every way that it's easy to forget how incredibly hard it was at this time to figure out exactly where the market was going and how fast it was going to get there. Did Sega screw up? Obviously they did. This was the beginning of the end of their period as a hardware manufacturer. But Nintendo also screwed up. The other new companies that tried to get in, 3DO and Atari Corp, which wasn't technically a new company, but was pretty new to the whole game console thing, because it's not the same company as Atari Inc., you know, look it up. They also made mistakes. Everybody that was trying to get into the market in this time period, and there were a lot of them, made fatal mistakes except for Sony. It was skill to a degree on Sony's part, sure, but some of it was also luck. So it's easy to look at the PlayStation and how well it did and the model it took and kind of say, why did those other idiots do it that other way? I hope that these episodes at least demonstrated that while, yes, those decisions ended up being stupid, it was just a very, very confusing time in the video game industry.
So if we're looking at this from a historical standpoint, what specifically were some of the stuff that you pulled in from Japanese sources that most surprised you that contradicted or reframed what we already knew?
Yeah, I think it was really important to see the Japanese perspective of the relationship between America and Japan, between the different subsidiaries. Because Kalinske, and I fully believe that he's telling the truth as he experienced it, I'm not accusing him of lying at all. He's always been very candid and open to me and to others about his experience at Sega. It's just that he only had limited insight into what was going on in Japan. Kalinske always told the story about how Japan wouldn't let them do anything anymore, was shoving stuff down their throats, yada, yada, yada. And I'm sure some of that was true. But what you really get when you've got testimony from people like Sato and Yuri Majuri and Nakayama on the other side is that they were actually at times really trying to bend over backwards to try to meet the needs of their American branch, even if they didn't always go about it in the most diplomatic way. You know, the 32X really is a wonderful example of collaboration between America and Japan, where America made a very passionate case, and Yuri Majuri describes this in his lecture that was translated that we've mentioned a couple of times. It was his responsibility right after he joined the company in 93 to go to the United States and kind of sort out all of their concerns about the Saturn and wanting something else to bridge that gap. He says that they made a very passionate case, and so he took that case back to Japan. And so it was actually a beautiful collaboration because America made its case, Japan listened, Japan went off and made something. America came back and said, that's not quite right. Then the American and Japanese engineers sat down at CES and kind of developed something together. And then Japan said, okay, you guys go run with it. You know, you guys design this thing, you know, trusted their design staff to design this thing. And of course, it ended up being a spectacularly bad decision and a spectacular failure and a big part of what sank the company. It wasn't because of a lack of communication and collaboration. It was actually a perfect textbook example of wonderful collaboration that just went completely awry for other reasons. So I think just getting a more nuanced understanding of that Sega parent company in Japan to Sega of America relationship was the most eye-opening thing about getting into those Japanese sources.
Certainly brings to light of Star Trek Next Generation is where Picard tells Data, it is possible to do everything right and still lose. That's not a failing of the company, it's just life.
Sometimes it can be, and while it would be going a little too far to say they did everything right, you certainly can't say that their entire philosophy on everything they were trying to do was wrong either.
Fair enough. In our next episode, we will be back on Earth, but who knows what horrors we will delve into.
Oh, we're not going back to Earth yet, Jeffrey. Oh, no.
But I already fueled up on Mars.
Yes, it seems that a Spacing Guild ship has shown up in Mars orbit, and we have been commanded by the Emperor to take over spice production on Arrakis, Jeffrey.
Oh, dear. I'm just going to have to go get my personal shields, and where's my knife? I need those. Knife.
That's right. Of course, at the time of this recording, Dune Part 2 is taking the box office by storm from Denis Villeneuve. Therefore, this seems like a perfect time to delve into the delightfully silly set of circumstances that led to the back-to-back releases of the games Dune and Dune 2, made by two completely different companies in two completely different gameplay styles, with nothing shared at all between them, which are somehow numbered sequentially. There's a very good reason for that, or I should say there's a very logical reason for that. I don't know that it's good. Rather than necessarily doing a deep dive on the creation of Cryo Interactive's Dune and Westwood Studios' Dune 2, I think it would be fun, in honor of the latest Dune Part 2, with also a special shout-out to Ethan Johnson, friend of the show, who suggested this topic in the first place, I might add, I thought it would be fun to explore the original Dune and Dune Part 2 and the crazy set of circumstances and corporate shenanigans that led to both of these games being developed, even though one of them had been canceled. And I don't mean they were planning to cancel it and the company made a last second plea and the publisher changed their mind. I mean it was canceled. Yet, we still had it anyway.
Well then, everyone, do some training for your Gundabar test, because it's a killer. And we'll see you next time on They Create Worlds. Check out our show notes at podcast.theycreateworlds.com, where we have linked to some of the things that we discuss in this and other episodes. You can check out Alex's video game history blog at videogamehistorian.wordpress.com. Alex's book, They Create Worlds, The Story of the People and Companies That Shaped the Video Game Industry, Volume 1, can now be ordered through Xerox Press and at major online retailers. Email us at feedback@theycreateworlds.com. Please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/theycreateworlds. You can also help by leaving a review on your favorite podcasting service. Intro music is Airplane Mode by Josh Woodward. Found at joshwoodward.com/song/airplane mode, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Outro music is Bacterial Love by Roller Music, found at freemusicarchive.org, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License.